It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Federal Election Commission is shorthanded in a big election year. We'll find out what the agency does and what a shortage of commissioners means for the 2020 campaign. First, science fiction isn't just about the distant future. It can offer unique perspectives on our current reality. In novels, movies, and in popular TV shows like Black Mirror, Man in the High Castle, The Handmaid's Tale, Watchmen, and all versions of The Twilight Zone. There's something about the alternate realities found in science fiction that fascinate us, but our next guest says they can also give us a lot of food for thought about the world we actually live in. David Barry is an associate professor of sociology and the sociology internship coordinator at the UW-Stevens Point. He recently gave a lecture on how society and science fiction overlap. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
David, as a sociologist, what got you interested in science fiction?
Well, like a lot of people, I grew up with Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and spent much of my youth watching those films and reading those books. But it wasn't actually until I started working as a sociologist that I started to realize the deep history and connections between our science and science fiction that have kind of always been there.
Yeah, talk about some of that history, those overlaps that you've seen.
Yeah, so some earlier examples actually include kind of the forefathers of American sociology, such as W.B. Du Bois, who was writing during the turn of the 19th century, or into the 19th and turn of the 20th century. And while he was writing a lot about what it was to be African American in the United States at that time, he was also dabbling in a lot of fiction and science fiction as well. He wrote a short story called The Comet that deals with race relations and identity at that time. Another example that I can think of is from another American sociologist, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who wrote a couple of different works of fiction and science fiction. One piece we might call either dystopian or utopian, depending on how you look at it, was the book or the novella Herland. And Herland kind of envisions a society of all women confronted with these male explorers, and then kind of the conflict unfolds there.
Before we dig into some more examples, what is the value of kind of stepping outside of our current reality and using different models, different situations as a way then to take it back and understand the world we live in?
Yeah, so while I don't necessarily research in science fiction directly, I have found kind of the use of science fiction and fantasy as a really nice kind of playground to wrestle with ideas and different topics for as an educator for students, and so it becomes kind of a neat kind of sometimes playful, but at least a safe place to be able to wrestle with big questions about race or big questions about sex or sexuality, education, and so forth.
So it can be a good conversation starter, it sounds like, amongst your students.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about a modern example, the movie Get Out. An African-American man goes on a weekend getaway with his white girlfriend to meet her family. Things start to get weird. We won't spoil too much, but he notices himself being treated differently, and the only other black people there also act strangely. Here's a clip where the girlfriend, Rose, is introducing Chris to some family members.
This is Nielsen and Alisa.
Hey, how you doing?
So, how handsome is he?
Are you into
that? Okay. Oh,
not bad. Hey, Nielsen. So, is it true? Is it better?
Wow. Fair skin has been in favor for the past, couple of hundreds of years. But now the pendulum is swung back. Black is in fashion.
And it keeps getting weirder from there. David, talk about the movie Get Out. I know this is an example you look at as far as a science fiction setting in a movie that has a lot of commentary on modern American culture.
Absolutely. So Jordan Peele's story here is a perfect example, perfect visualization of what W.B. Du Bois called two-ness or double consciousness. And while he was looking primarily at what it meant to be black in America during the early 20th century, a lot of these ideas can be extrapolated to talk about really any member of any marginalized group. And really the idea behind this idea of two-ness or double consciousness is that as a member of a marginalized group, you create this kind of identity schism where you're, on the one hand, a part of the majority culture, but at the same time, very much ostracized from it. And some of the kind of psychological and emotional, and then certainly the social consequences that unfold when you have this kind of dualistic identity that you have to contend with for the rest of your life.
Talking to David Barry, sociologist at UW-Stevens Point, looking at science fiction and what it can tell us about American culture, how science fiction alternate realities can inform us about our actual realities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a science fiction novel or TV show or movie that maybe started conversations amongst you and your friends or family members about the world we live in? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Now, Black Mirror is another sci-fi show that I think very intentionally is trying to stay just ahead of our reality to extrapolate out where things go. Here's a taste of one episode called Nosedive, where we kind of rate each other. We have a, you know, like you might rate a business, but we're rating each other on our phones, everybody from the person at the coffee shop to the person checking our bags in an airport. Here's a scene where the main character is talking with an airport attendant after she's found out her flight has been canceled.
I see there's one standby seat on another plane leaving tonight. That's reserved for members of our Prime Flight program. You gotta be a 4.2 or over to qualify.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
I'm afraid you're actually a 4.183.
Oh. Well, that's not my fault. Some woman dinged me down in the cab drive. Can't you just...
I'm sorry, it won't let me book it without the correct ranking.
But it's so close.
There's just nothing I can do.
Christ, I mean, surely.
I'm going to have to ask you to moderate your language there.
A lot of science fiction over the years, David, has taken one small element of culture, of society, and extrapolated out what if it became bigger. This Black Mirror episode, one example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like a lot of what Black Mirror does, but this this episode really kind of hits it on the nose. And by kind of staying one step ahead of society as we see it right now, it really calls into question a lot of the things that we take for granted. So the idea that we have a financial credit score rating is something that's just kind of given to us and we rarely question, but a social credit score is something that we would be appalled at. But really, in so many informal and indirect ways, we use social media to do just that, and really that's what sociology and other social sciences are all about, is taking that stuff that we take for granted and really ask why and where that comes from.
Well, it's interesting to think about. In a lot of ways, we live in a science fiction world now. If you went back to the 1970s and said, hey, yeah, we're all going to have our own personal communicators that we can get recipes from and, you know, make fun of world leaders on and listen to music on and watch videos on and be nice and mean to each other on. I mean, that would have inspired science fiction books and movies right there, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of our attention when we think about science fiction and fantasy and so forth is kind of projecting into the future. But I think that a kind of another interesting area is the speculative history too. And there's a lot of kind of upcoming work influenced by earlier work where we may reimagine history in different ways too, as a way to perhaps get us thinking about society today.
Talking to David Barry, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Stevens Point. We're talking about some of our favorite science fiction shows, movies, and books, and what they can tell us about the society we live in and what kind of conversations they can start. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched shows like The Twilight Zone, Black Mirror, Man in the High Castle? Do you enjoy the science fiction genre in print, TV, or movies? Is there a movie or TV show or science fiction book that got you thinking, that changed your perspective on the world, or you think offers interesting commentary on the world we live in? Join in with your thoughts and your examples at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with David Barry, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Stevens Point, talking about science fiction and what shows, movies, books can tell us about the society we live in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you enjoyed a science fiction show, movie, or book? Maybe on TV, Black Mirror, Get Out, Handmaid's Tale. What captured your interest? Is there an example from the science fiction world that you think says something or gives us interesting thoughts about the world we live in or imagines alternatives to the world we live in that you find appealing, frightening, little of both? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Amber on Facebook, who writes that the predicaments a futuristic setting offers allow us to look at and think about progress versus morality. When you stifle one for the other, Amber says, I think this question plagues us as a society more than anything else. So science fiction weighing progress versus the impacts it can have, the moral decisions we have to make. David, is that a common theme?
Yeah, I think so. And kind of going back to an earlier comment that I had made about how science fiction and related genres can be an interesting playground to wrestle around with certain ideas. But I think there's a limitation there, too, and maybe even a risk that we find any attempts to engage in that content as being just unrealistic and recreational, and therefore not take maybe not take it seriously. But I think that a lot of the themes that come out of any of these genres of fiction can be very relatable to people's everyday experiences and lives.
Right. With science fiction, or as you're saying, any other genre, there can be, I don't know, among certain literary circles, this idea, well, you look down at it, it's just escapism or just genre fiction, not a big deal. Right. Is that unfair?
I would argue that it is unfair. And really, when I go back to some of those earlier works that I mentioned, like with W. Du Bois and Charlotte Perkins Gilman, a lot of the reasons why they were writing those pieces of work was about accessibility. Not a lot of people had access to good science. And so this access to good knowledge is, you know, a common thing for us today. But, you know, the use of fiction as a way to get these science themes out to the larger public was an avenue, was intentional. And we certainly see examples of that today too.
Let's talk about dystopia a little bit. You know, you can go back to, you know, 1984 by George Orwell, or We by Yevgeny Zamyatin and others,
yeah,
all the way up to, you know, there's a huge boom in the young adult science fiction and fantasy dystopias with The Hunger Games and all that. What are we doing there? Why are we so interested in like a worst case scenario?
Yeah, well, I think that as you know, ideally as development changes and improves for any given society, I think there are always these big questions of, you know, what if it all collapses? And so I think that that's kind of a common theme in any human condition to ask those big what if questions, and it just seems to manifest in those in some of those genres.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Stevens Point. Dave, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What'd you want to bring up, Dave?
Well, you know, I just was listening to your program, and it brought up some childhood memories. I remember, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, we lived out in Plover, and we only had two channels with our rabbit ears, and we going to my grandmother's house in Stevens Point, and she had cable, and we used to get a feed, or she got a feed, you know, and I included WGN on Chicago, and just played some classic serials at the time, like Time Tunnel, and one in particular was Space 1999, and, you know, at the time I thought, boy, you know, it seems so far away. By then we should be able to, you know, have a colony on the moon, and the aspects of that show that I thought, you know, with the space race at the time, that maybe was a realistic goal, other than some of the facets of the show, like the shape-shifting and, or some of the, you know, alien-type stuff. But, you know, I guess at the time, it just seemed like that would be something that I'd think by 2020, here we are, that would have occurred.
Dave, thanks for the call. Yeah, we're 21 years past due on Space 1999. But David, that the way science fiction can influence our visions of the future, whether or not those visions come true.
Yeah, so a lot of our examples so far have been things happening on Earth, but we haven't talked so much about space yet. And one example that I like to point to, while I'm not familiar with the programs that the listener had brought up, Stanley Kubrick's epic film 2001 Space Odyssey is a really great example. Here you have a director who put a lot of effort and intention in developing how he thought a space station could look like. And when that was developed, that very greatly influenced NASA engineers into developing the International Space Station that we all know today. And NASA has on their webpage has some great resources on how that film was just kind of visually and aesthetically really impressive on those engineers as they developed that.
Dave, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Casey joins us next in Sun Prairie. Casey, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a sci-fi series that's very near and dear to my heart. It was first a book series by an author named James S.A. Corey called The Expanse. It's now streaming on Amazon. And the really cool thing about that series is that it explores the socioeconomic impacts of colonizing the solar system. You know, what do you do with these people you send into space? What happens to them? They can't come back. And so you've got this kind of exploited workforce that's in space. You've got a higher, like high sci-fi plot going on as well. But a lot of it has to do with that culture. And they've invented this great culture, really deep and colorful culture of belters. They live in the asteroid belt. Who tend to be exploited by the inner planets. But I think that's especially relevant. You have people like Elon Musk, who's proposing sending indentured servants to Mars, for instance. And that's very relevant to what we're heading into as the human race.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call. I'm on book 4 of the novels and season 2, I think, of the TV show myself.
Yep.
But yeah, sometimes you look at science fiction and a lot of our problems of the current era are magically gone. As Casey is saying in this one example and some others, you know, exploited people extracting resources, that's an issue in the future as it is now.
Absolutely. And while I haven't read the books, I have watched all the seasons so far. So you know, you brought up some of the economic consequences of colonialization, but also the cultural and ethic and ethical and moral obligations as well. There's also a really major theme about sustainability that comes out of that that program as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Casey. We're talking to David Berry from UW-Stevens Point, sociologist there. He gives talks about the overlap between sociology and the worlds of science fiction. David, a lot of science fiction also looks at identity, what it means to be a human. Philip K. Dick was famous for this. He is certainly not the only one. Do you have thoughts on how science fiction can talk to us about how we define who we are?
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned Philip K. Dick and one of his short stories that was later turned or more recently turned into a program on Amazon, The Man in the High Castle, which again is this kind of speculative history, kind of reimagining the United States as if they had lost World War II. And out of that kind of plot in that story, some really big questions about national identity and xenophobia, along with just other massive geopolitical considerations, come out. And even though this is a speculative past, a lot of those themes tell us a lot about kind of rising nationalism and xenophobia in our own country today.
Let's go back to our callers. Michael is with us in Madison. Michael, hello.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to touch down on Get Out. I'm a younger black man, and I thought it was some of what you were saying was really interesting. And I think one thing to pinpoint for me is that after I saw Get Out, and having conversations with my friends who weren't black, there were multiple elements that are actually a part of my day-to-day life that in the way that they were presented in the movie, a lot of my friends were like, oh, isn't it crazy how this happened? Or, you know, isn't it crazy that when he showed up to her house, everybody was so interested in him and blah, 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 blah. But I think it's interesting because there are these parts of science fiction movies, particularly that one, where depending on what your experience is walking through life, certain things can appear to be science fiction when in fact they are far more normal and they're everyday happenings for some of us. So I just I thought it was interesting that you the ways in which you guys were pinpointing on things. I think that it's weird how you can kind of straddle the line between reality and science fiction based upon your walk, you know, through life.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. David, what do you think?
Absolutely. And really, you know, the point of thinking about the genres associated with science fiction is really hoping that they are useful conversation starters so that that those conversations and discussions are had.
What's kind of inspiring, thanks for that call again, Michael. It's inspiring and it's kind of sad at the same time, David, to think that we might need to turn to science fiction you know, just to understand people, you know, living in the same town with us just because they're in a different, slightly different walk of life.
Absolutely. But I'll try to reign true in my optimism here to say that this allows for us to engage with one another and at least to begin to have those conversations and to be able to share those experiences with one another as well.
Thanks again for the call, Michael. In our last couple of minutes, David, any other examples in your readings and or viewings that you'd point us toward for interesting science fiction commentary?
Oh, boy. There's so much to be said in only a few more minutes. But I would point to, you know, some more contemporary examples as we think about how the social sciences and fiction and so forth are really connected. So while a lot of my examples were of those early sociologists, there's a lot of really interesting work being done today, too. And I would point to one anthology titled Octavia's Brood, which is an edited volume of a number of social scientists and social activists, edited by Adrienne Marie Brown. And in it, there are a number of fiction and science fiction and fantasy stories that do a lot what W.E.B. Du Bois was trying to do and Gilman was trying to do as well. But what's really unique here is that these are from marginalized voices that we would typically not hear in the larger canon of sociology.
And Octavia's Brood, inspired, I think, by Octavia Butler, the late science fiction
author. Yeah.
All right, David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
That's David Barry, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. He joined us today to talk about how we can understand more about our society, our identities, and our reality through watching or reading science fiction. Still time for you to share your favorites, your examples, some science fiction that maybe made you think about the real world as well. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Look forward to maybe getting some recommendations from you. Coming up after the news, there aren't enough commissioners on the Federal Election Commission. We'll find out what that means in a big election year, what the commission itself does, why it doesn't have enough commissioners, and what it can mean for things like campaign finance violations. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a college in South Dakota has official accreditation recognized by the federal government. Just one problem, it doesn't seem to exist. A reporter tells us what happened when they tried to report on a school with no signs of students, professors, or anything. First, we hear a lot about the Federal Election Commission in the news. Not surprisingly, we hear about them a lot during an election year. The agency first opened its doors in 1975. Its job to enforce campaign finance law in U.S. political races. 2020 is a big election year, but there's a problem at the commission. There aren't enough commissioners. That means they can't do parts of their job. Our next guest joins us to talk about the challenges facing the agency today, why the commission membership has dwindled, and what potential impact it could have on the 2020 elections. Chara Torres-Spellacy is the author of the book Political Brands. She teaches constitutional law at Stetson University in Florida, and she's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Chara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a crash course in what the Federal Election Commission is supposed to do from year to year.
So the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, was a post-Watergate reform. Part of what was revealed in Watergate was a lot of different campaign finance crimes or bad reporting of campaign finance. And so it was set up to bring transparency of money in politics at the federal level. So one of the things that they do is they enforce campaign finance laws, and they require disclosure from people who are spending in politics, whether that's the candidates, political parties, PACs, super PACs. All of those entities end up reporting to the FEC.
What's going on at the FEC that there aren't enough of them? They're short of commissioners to run the place.
Correct. So the FEC was designed to be bipartisan. They have three Republican appointees and three Democratic appointees. Pardon me. And you need four commissioners to agree to do anything. And right now, they don't even have four commissioners, which means that they have lost their quorum. And they can do very, very little. I mean, the FEC is still technically operational. So, for example, individuals who would legally need to report their political spending still have to report.
Why, before we get into some of the consequences of the shortage, why, if there's supposed to be six of them, why aren't they being appointed and approved? Why do we have this shortage?
Well, the appointment is at President Trump's behest, so he can appoint or not appoint, and then those appointments have to be approved by the Senate, like any vacancy in the federal government. And Trump had vacancies earlier in his presidency, and he didn't fill them, and then the vacancies sort of started to pile up to the point of the last person left effective September 1st of last year. So we've had 6 months without a quorum at the FEC, which means that they can't enforce laws and they can't promulgate new rules.
So am I hearing you right? A Republican president, as we have now, is in charge of appointing even the Democratic commissioners, and vice versa, a Democratic president would nominate the Republican commissioners?
Yes. So it tends to be the Republican delegation in the Senate and the Democratic delegation in the Senate that suggest names to the White House to fill the slots on the FEC. But yes, every president could have the possibility of putting in Republican and Democratic seats on the FEC.
Chara Torres-Bellacy is with us from Stetson University in Florida, looking at the Federal Election Commission, what they do, what they can't do without enough commissioners, which they don't have right now. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. Chara, what kind of things do you need a quorum of commissioners to actually do when it comes to enforcing our campaign finance laws?
So, for example, if you wanted to impose a civil fine for breaking a campaign finance law. So, for example, back when they did have a quorum, one of the things that they did is they fined a super PAC that had supported Jeb Bush in the 2016 campaign. And the reason that they enforced this fine against that super PAC is it had illegally taken money from a company that was controlled by a Chinese national. And that goes against the longstanding prohibition on foreign nationals intervening in U.S. elections. So when they have a quorum, they can, if you have four out of the six voting yes on a particular thing, or if you just have four commissioners and they all vote yes, then you can do things like impose those civil fines.
Is there a partisan gridlock sometimes, even when there's three of each? So three Democrats vote one way, three Republicans vote another, and that blocks enforcement sometimes?
That happens all the time at the FEC. So because of the bipartisan makeup and because they don't have an odd number of commissioners, the way, say, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that always has an odd number of commissioners, which means that that commission can actually function because you just have majority rule. And instead, at the Federal Election Commission, you have this even number of commissioners on a bipartisan basis, and that often leads to 3-3 deadlocks at the FEC, which means that they don't make rules that we need, or they will refuse to enforce the laws that we already have on the books because it just comes down to this 3-3 tie.
Now, with that possibility and also now without this quorum, if I start a super PAC, and I won't, but if I did, can I just take foreign donations left and right? It's the Wild West and there's no sheriff in town?
Well, this is one of my great fears, is that because the primary regulator can't act, that might invite a certain lawlessness, though there is a backup. So the DOJ has control over willful violations of campaign finance law, and on occasion, the DOJ will actually enforce campaign finance law. Like, you could ask Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney, who is presently a guest of the state because he violated campaign finance laws, and it was DOJ that actually enforced that part of the law against him.
We're talking right now to Chara Torres-Pellacy. She teaches constitutional law at Stetson University in Florida, and she's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. She's with us to talk about the role of the Federal Election Commission and how the agency's lack of a quorum could affect a big election year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the Federal Election Commission, what it does, what laws it enforces? Do you want to see more rigorous federal enforcement of the campaign finance laws still in place? Are you concerned about the ones that have changed and how that changed what money can go into politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the Federal Election Commission, also known as the FEC, specifically about its role in our election process, how it's functioning today, and a current shortfall. There aren't enough appointed commissioners to run the place and do a lot of the enforcement of campaign finance laws that, in theory, the agency would do, especially in a big election year like this one. Chara Torres-Pellacy is with us. She teaches constitutional law at Stetson University in Florida. She's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the Federal Election Commission, what it does and doesn't do? Do you want to see stricter enforcement of campaign finance laws when it comes to, say, foreign investment in American elections, contrary to American law or other violations? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Chara, we've talked some about foreign money coming into U.S. elections. That's one of the things the FEC might enforce. What other kind of things constitute violations in our current legal makeup?
So if you give a donation to a federal candidate that is larger than the hard money limits, that's a violation. If you spend in an election and you are not a green card holder, then that's illegal. Sort of ironically, dark money, which is money that's spent in federal elections but doesn't name the underlying donor, most of that dark money is actually legal. And this is one of the things that the FEC really could use their quorum for when they get it back. They really need to promulgate rules that require better transparency of where money really comes from that is spent in our politics. But they've had a decade to do this. It wasn't just that they lost their quorum and, oh, the dark money rule doesn't go through. They have never gotten their act together post-Citizens United to deal with the problem of dark money. And so as a consequence, we've had $1 billion of dark money spent in federal elections since Citizens United.
Yeah, Citizens United and the McCutcheon decisions were quite a while ago. And in theory, it's the FEC's job to take those decisions and put them into rule form. Is that right?
And that's what you would normally expect. So sort of ironically, when the court has done things that are sort of more restrictive in campaign finance, often you will get rules from the FEC that sort of undermine those court rulings. And yet when we have these permissive rulings on campaign finance, They don't put in place the transparency that the American public deserves about where money in politics is flowing, which was, again, it was a post-Watergate reform. That is basically their whole job, is to make things more transparent.
Has there been criticism of the idea that, okay, we want people to enforce our campaign finance laws? The people we pick to enforce it are going to be there representing the political parties who are, you know, maybe trying to bend those laws to the breaking point in their own interests?
Well, there's always a fox guarding the hen house aspect of campaign finance law, but it's a little bit of an endemic problem, in part because we don't have philosopher kings who can run things for us. Everything is the product of elections and appointments by political actors. So you never really get the politics out of the way that we regulate elections.
Now, even when things are working as they should be at the FEC, are there Federal Election Commission agents out there sniffing out violations of campaign finance, or are they just kind of there waiting for somebody to report a suspected violation?
They are still taking reports of violations, and so, you know, if one of your listeners happens to know of an ongoing campaign finance violation in the federal elections, then they should report to the FEC, because eventually, whether it's with President Trump appointing new commissioners or whoever is the next president appointing those commissioners, they will fill these slots eventually. And then the commission will look back at what happened in the past election. So they'll look back at 2020 and they'll see whether people who were supposed to filed and were any campaign finance laws violated while the commission was sort of put into this, inability to act because of their loss of their quorum.
Now, there's another thing about enforcement of campaign finance laws. If we break the law in the lead up to the 2020 election, and it's not going to be reviewed or punished until 2021, and you don't do a do-over on the election after that, that seems like it might not be as powerful an incentive to prevent that kind of illegal spending.
True, though, if you have a willful violation of campaign finance laws, again, DOJ does have the ability in real time, like right now, to investigate those alleged violations of law, and if they find credible evidence, to go ahead and prosecute. So in one sense, we may have a delay in terms of the civil enforcement of campaign finance law, which is essentially what the FEC does. So, you know, when sort of more minor things are broken in the campaign finance system, they will levy fees and fines. But when there's a willful violation of campaign finance law, that's when it gets to the level of being a prosecutable offense that DOJ can handle. And they can handle that right now. Like, the fact that the FEC doesn't have a quorum doesn't stop the overlapping jurisdiction that the Department of Justice still has.
As we wrap up, Chara, as you mentioned, eventually these spots will be filled. Is there any indication that there's movement to do that in 2020?
I've seen no reporting to that effect. This is in the hand of the president. If he felt like appointing new commissioners, he could do it tomorrow.
Chara, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Chara Torres-Spellacy, author of the book Political Brands. She teaches constitutional law at Stetson University in Florida. She's also a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. She joined us today to give a crash course in what the Federal Election Commission does and why it is short-handed in this election year, with apparently no prospect of filling the commission and getting a quorum to help with enforcement anytime before Election Day. A recent survey found Milwaukee is one of the worst cities for black women. The city ranked in the bottom five on a national livability index and ranks last in the country for economic outcomes. Corrine Hess reports that some black women business owners are trying to build on pockets of success.
It's a busy afternoon at Sherman Phoenix on Milwaukee's north side. The business incubator has been a beacon of hope in the city since it opened a little over a year ago in a neighborhood that has seen countless acts of violence. The 30 restaurants and small shops at Sherman Phoenix are nearly all owned by African Americans, and many of those owners are women. Adesia Smith ran a commercial bakery out of her home for about a decade. She says she's been baking since she was knee-high to her grandmother. Smith says when she opened Confectionately Yours on November 30th, 2018, there were some bumps, but she says nothing worth having comes easy.
There's been a lot of things that we've had to learn on the go and as we have grown. So now hopefully we'll have the opportunity to pass some of those things to people who are seeking to be in this position as well.
Smith wants to see more women who look like her open businesses, especially in Milwaukee.
We've been known to be one of the most segregated cities in the United States, and I do think it does come with the territory, unfortunately.
Despite successes like Sherman Phoenix, research continues to show black female entrepreneurs face racial and gender wealth gaps and negative bias. A report from the Kauffman Foundation found just 2% of venture capital financing goes to women, and more than 20% of black entrepreneurs say lack of financing hurts their ability to be profitable.
It is really systemic and institutionalized racism and sexism. It's not one or the other. It's both those things at the same time.
That's Nicole Mason. She heads the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. From 2002 to 2012, the number of businesses owned by black women increased by nearly 200%. But businesses owned by black women have lower sales among all racial and ethnic groups, the Institute found. Mason says women often blame themselves.
If their business closes, often they internalize it and say, well, it's maybe something I didn't do right or I didn't have the right business plan. But they don't look at systems and lack of systems and supports in place to help their business grow and thrive.
Back at Sherman Phoenix, Smith says she's trying to change the narrative by sharing her experiences. She also believes there is access to capital, marketing, and other services that some black entrepreneurs aren't aware of.
With the support of the collaborative organizations that do not see color, but they just see genuine people with genuine gifts and talents that can be successful coming together, then we can make that narrative louder.
Some of those organizations include the African American Chamber of Commerce, BizStarts, and Generator. Molly Dill is a director with G Beta Milwaukee. Generator's free, 7-week program that gives entrepreneurs a chance to receive guidance from mentors, investors, and potential customers. Dill holds office hours weekly at Sherman Phoenix and in other locations across the city.
I think the demographics of the best and brightest in the community is probably representative of the demographics of the community itself. So we work hard to try to cast a wide net that requires, rather than just who raises their hand to do this kind of work.
City Alder Malaley Coggs has hosted the MKE Business Now Entrepreneurship Summit for 9 years to connect men and women, mostly of color, with city and private resources. Coggs says the number of summit attendees has quadrupled. This year, there were about 400.
There are countless people doing it every single day and trying to find creative ways to still be entrepreneurs and to have some success. And what I appreciate most is there are so many of them sharing their experiences with others.
Coggs and others working with black business owners say the challenges in Milwaukee are real, but progress is being made. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
More than a third of the delegates for the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee are up for grabs, and the results of today's Super Tuesday could shake up the race and narrow the field even more. You can hear live NPR coverage tonight at 7 on the News and Classical Network of Wisconsin Public Radio or stream live over at WPR.org. And then get some Super Tuesday follow-up tomorrow on the morning show from 8 to 9 a.m. Kate Archer-Kent and Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel will talk about today's results and what they could mean looking ahead at when voting eventually comes here to Wisconsin, for the Democratic primary. Then at 3:30 tomorrow, our weekly roundup of the latest news in national politics. We'll check out the Super Tuesday results, see if the field has narrowed at all. And as always, you'll be able to join in both the morning show and Central Time with your own reactions. That's Super Tuesday coverage, lots of it, tonight and tomorrow here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We love dinosaur news here on Central Time. Here's something we missed last month amidst all the hullabaloo. Canadian researchers unveiled fossils from a newly discovered species that's a cousin of the Tyrannosaurus rex. The fossils were discovered by hikers Sandra and John DeGroote in Alberta. It's pretty cool. Apparently, if you discover a fossil, you might get your name attached to the species. In this case, the DeGroots were honored in the official name Thanatotheristes DeGrootorum. That accounts for the last part of the name. Let's get to the first part. Thanatotheristes. The scientists who named the species said, "We chose a name that embodies what this tyrannosaur was as the only known large apex predator of its time in Canada." The name translates as Reaper of Death. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Rob, you and I should start a thrash metal band and call it Reaper of Death, because that's a totally metal name. I answer you in two parts. One, you're absolutely right, and B, you're too late. I did some cutting-edge journalistic research and found that there was an Irish thrash metal band named Reaper of Death, though their latest recording and social media posts appear to date back to 2013. They could, I guess, reunite inspired by the new dinosaur. I found a recording of the band, and it's probably a bit much to play just now. This is not Reaper of Death on Central Time.